everyone, and welcome back to the New Plaza Cinema Podcast, the podcast made by cinephiles for cinephiles. This time around, the New Plaza Cinema crew meets to discuss Michelangelo Antonioni's first English language film and one of the first semi-Hollywood films to merge the worlds of art house cinema and mainstream filmmaking at the height of the UK mod movement, the 1966 classic Blow Up. So, with all that being said, we hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, everyone, again. Well, I believe it's just by coincidence that with this year's Cannes Film Festival now in full swing, we're focusing today on Michelangelo Antonioni's Blow Up, which was the winner in 1967 of the festival's top prize, the Palme d'Or. I was very fortunate to attend the festival a number of times over the years and occasionally to catch, during some off hours, a classic film screening or two, which the festival always features as a sidebar event. Back in 2004, I was present for a screening of Blow Up, along with a new short film by our Italian maestro about another artist named Michelangelo. Antonioni was by then in his early 90s and had to be very delicately escorted to the stage, but his mere appearance produced an ovation from that full house. I think he actually made another short film that same year after that, part of a three-part omnibus called Eros, along with Wong Kar-wai and Steven Soderbergh, a very unlikely trio. Now, every generation, I think, has a different response to Blow Up. In its initial release, it made waves all over the world, changed movie mores and production codes, provoked perhaps equal amounts of worship and derision, as well as satire. I remember the Mad Magazine parody called Throw Up. And when I first saw it a decade later, my own reaction was I really admired the amazing technical precision, as always with Antonioni, the mixture of passion and emotional detachment. But it felt to me kind of a mid-range achievement, what I think over time we've come to see as an extraordinary movie-making career. Now, Max, this time you were successful in finding one of those often elusive original trailers, which are often very revelatory.
Yes, Gary, just a quick backstory. The film was denied a seal of approval from the Production Code Administration. As many of us know, it was condemned by the National Catholic Office of Motion Pictures. So what MGM did is they simply removed their name from the credits and formed a separate producing entity called Premier Productions to handle the release of Blow Up. Columbia had done that, and 20th Century Fox and United Artists had done that with the so-called adult specialized film. So with this non-MGM, MGM release, I think it's safe to say that the studio was focusing on the sexiness and the sexual aspects of Antonioni's smash success of 1966. This is the original Blow Up trailer.
Blow Up is an astonishing glimpse of today, seen through Antonioni's camera, his color, his London, his first English language film.
I thought you were supposed to be in Paris.
I am.
And then we have the critic.
That's a very good trailer. I wonder who cut that trailer. Very, very staccato for its time.
It was, and it had followed a teaser which just had the still photos in it. There was the narrator, but it didn't have any actual footage from the movie as this one did. But no, you're right. There's a good energy to it.
And I'm sure it was very effective at the box office.
It was. So it opens in the latter part of 1966 to surprisingly positive reviews for the most part here in the United States, and becomes a very considerable art house success. I mean, actually crossing over to more general release audiences.
Even the very stuffy New York Times critic at that time, a gentleman named Bosley Crowther, I see had it on his 10 best list. He was in the last year of about a 25-year run as a New York Times film critic and was supposedly canned in 1967 for panning Bonnie and Clyde and a few other films that, you know, were taken seriously by most other critics.
He did love Blow Up. It had gotten generally good notices. And it came on the heels of a series of important films that Antonioni made, primarily in Italy. There was that bourgeois alienation trilogy with La Ventura and La Notte and Le Clis, which angered a lot of people. I remember that with La Ventura, you have a young woman disappearing during a vacation, and they look for her for a while and then give up and go home, and she's never mentioned again. And that infuriated a lot of people. And then Le Clis, I can't remember whether that was the second or third in the trilogy. You have the last 7 minutes. The film continues after the actors have ended their participation, and you just see the camera gliding through neighborhoods where the narrative had taken place. And in Blow Up, it's basically a thriller of a man who may or may not have photographed a murder. And he seems to be a little indifferent towards it. And the film sort of gets distracted from that. And that also, I think, annoyed people who were accustomed to the more conventional thriller structure. Any thoughts on that?
Well, even Andrew Saris in The Village Voice, who had a sense of humor from time to time, I remember reading his review where he said, well, I wonder what the executives of MGM are thinking. Who is this Mike Antonioni who thinks he has his finger on the pulse of the world or young people and so forth? But at that particular moment in time, it seems that he did.
And you had told me the other day that it was your understanding that he intended it to be an Italian film or shot in Italy.
I don't think you heard that from me.
It may have been maybe Dan Cahill told me.
It was for me. But the church in Italy would never have allowed him to shoot that in Italy. That was his statement.
Thank you, Dan. And I would argue that maybe 3 or 4 years later, it would have been less of a problem to do that. But this was all about knocking down taboos. And you do have an unusual structure. There's this definite leisurely Antonioni pace where you're really getting a sense of the Hemmings character. What I think has not been given adequate discussion is we associate Blow Up with this quintessential mod London movie. But at the very beginning, Antonioni does show the contrasts. I mean, you do see the mimes racing around the very hip London, but you see David Hemmings' photographer character. He is been going on a photographic assignment in a working class atmosphere, I want to say a factory.
And well, there's the expression that he uses in the film called a Doss House, D-O-S-S,
Doss House,
which apparently is like sort of what we would call a homeless shelter, I think, in NYC. And he's in there on some kind of apparently socially responsible photo book project where he's taking pictures of these, you know, down and outers of London, while at the same time being engaged in much more licentious photography and personal gratification almost simultaneously.
Right. So you do see that class consciousness in the film. And even later on, where he's meeting with the man I presume is his editor of a book he's working on, which features the photographs from that Doss House, and Hemming wants to add what he hopes would be those revealing photographs of the Vanessa Redgrave Park photos.
Including apparently a photo thrown in as an in-joke of the South American author Julio Cortazar, whose short story Blow Up is based on.
There you have it. But it's just the use of color, the use of composition, which is in contrast to what we tend to associate with more modish filmmaking of that time. There's so much to admire in where Antonioni puts his camera and how he stages the actors. Seeing an Antonioni film for the first time in English, because the previous ones, of course, were Italian, you really do get a sense of the minimalism in the dialogue.
I was trying to find a dialogue list for the film, and my usual source, a website called opensubtitles.org, was down over the weekend, but you could go in there and pull up an English dialogue, you know, a transcription, and I bet you're not going to come up with more than 300 titles, which is very, very few for a feature film. Now, we were screening My Night at Maud's this afternoon, Max and I at the theater. I bet there was 1,500 subtitles in that film. There's just so much dialogue.
Easily, easily. And there are segments of Blow Up which are purely visual. And of course, the most famous being the scene where he is analyzing the photos he's just taken out of the dark room and enlarging them and just driving around the city where there is no dialogue and the dialogue that takes place is almost incidental. I wish I had taken more notes about those sparse words that were exchanged, but when he's with Sarah, or Sarah Miles visits his studio towards the end and she asks who it was who was killed and he just responds, "Someone."
Mm-hmm.
A quintessential Antonioni line.
Well, and of course, yeah, that whole sequence, very influential when he determines what's going on with the photos by blowing them up and posting them side by side, stolen pretty much whole hog by Francis Coppola in The Conversation, Brian De Palma in Blowout, and others I'm sure I'm not thinking of.
This is where I go, la, 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 whenever I hear.
But as Francis Coppola said in an interview once, well, my father always told me, always steal from the best.
I had heard that too. And The Conversation is, in fact, I guess, an audio take on Blow Up. I mean, it even opens with a mime in a park during the opening credits, as Blow Up is bookended by the mimes, Jerry Shields, if memory serves. So you do have this influence that Blow Up had, although The Conversation does follow more of a, I don't want to say conventional, but there's definitely a straight thriller track there. Whereas Blow Up, you do have the side tracks to his work as a fashion photographer. You see the fling he has with the two models, one of whom was Jane Birkin. You see when the story is supposed to really be heating up towards the end, there's that side trip to the Yardbirds concert.
I guess that had to be in there because that was part of the marketing campaign or something, where we see Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page smashing their guitars. And
I'm sure it contributed to the great popularity of the film. But it is interesting how these were obviously deliberate narrative choices on Antonioni's part. And he did that before. He would continue to do it again.
Well, now I think time has vindicated those early 60s films that you spoke about, La Ventura, Les Clis, The Red Desert. These are all considered masterworks now. And I think that Blow Up is more, I think, and we'll see what Dan thinks, more a product of its time, certainly also, you know, surpassingly well-made, but not in the same league, I think, as those earlier films. As Jean-Luc Godard said, I think he was talking about Taxi Driver in this case. He said, well, when a seriously intentioned film becomes a big popular success, it's because of a misunderstanding. And I think that's the same is true, I think, here of Blow Up. It's kind of a head-scratchingly amazing that it was as successful as it was. And that's the kind of thing that keeps us all awake and alert here at the movie watching table at New Plaza Cinema.
It's true. And when I talked about Europe versus the censors when writing about international cinema in the 50s and 60s, where the tremendous success that a number of specialized films had at that time, it had as much to do with the salacious nature that audiences were expecting more frank approaches to sex and adult relationships and possibly nudity in a film coming from Europe than they would from a Hollywood picture in the 1950s or 60s. And Blow Up has to also have been a part of that misunderstanding and expectation. Although in this case, it certainly delivers the goods.
It's just astounding to me. How do they get away with it? Like looking at it again this week, there's at least a couple of very discernible shots of female full frontal nudity when they're rolling around on the sticky paper or whatever. I mean, how did they get away with that? I bet there was some scissors yielded in certain conservative areas of America, probably in some of those scenes in the projection booths.
I had also talked about, you mentioned Blow Up was shown, you say it was the Cannes Festival in 67.
That's right, which would never happen today. The film actually opened in New York in December of 1966. There's a fascinating making of, which I'll talk about a little bit more later, but you see some shots of the late lamented Baronet and Coronet Theater having the New York City premiere in Bloomingdale's across the street when those theaters were the center of the movie going universe in New York. The film opened in December of 1966. It wasn't shown in Cannes until the following spring and not released in Italy, probably because of censorship issues, until like the late summer of 1967 after everybody's vacation.
A year earlier, or shall I say, in May of 1966, months before Blow Up opened. John Frankenheimer's psychological horror film Seconds opened at Cannes. That version was censored because it originally contained a sequence, a grape stomping sequence that the Rock Hudson character attends, yes, in which there's graphic nudity there, including full frontal female nudity. And Paramount demanded that Frankenheimer remove that footage. And it was cut in the US. I believe it was cut in the UK. It showed in certain European countries, and we didn't get to see it on DVD until the late 90s. But there was something that shifted by the end of 1966, where MGM allowed Antonioni to get away with it.
We also had another watershed that year, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And I think, yes, all these pictures were released without the global icon seal of approval that we've become used to seeing from the Motion Picture Association of America, and hastened the creation of the rating system about 2 years later.
Exactly. And the scene that you're mentioning, Gary, with the two young women.
Just let the arms go up and down. Yes, very tasty. Yes, I like it. I like it. Go on. Yeah. All right, change position.
That was the scene that caused MGM the greatest concern. And they apparently did want Antonio to cut that scene. He refused. And that's when the studio, I mean, to its credit, rather than being bossy and demanding, they said, okay, let's just come up with a distribution label that'll confuse people. We'll call it Premiere, and we'll send it out with this technically non-Motion Picture Association related distribution company, which is how Blow Up was able to be released uncut.
Right. Now today, of course, the version that's out today, we proudly have the standard, you know, presented by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer at the very end, you know, their usual credit that they have for all their films.
And in some of the versions of Blow Up that I remember even seeing on television in the early 70s when it was chopped to pieces and in revival cinemas, there was the MGM logo at the beginning. So I guess after a few short years, they put that back on. And then because Blow Up was such a surprise success, they gave Antonioni way too much money and freedom on his next picture, which was Zabriskie Point, which was, of course, not successful.
Was he nominated for the Oscar for Blow Up for Best Director that year?
I would have to check.
We'll look that up.
Before we get to Dan,
This is going to be a feast for Dan.
It will be a feast for Dan, but we do have David Hemmings in the lead character here, who hadn't made a lot of well-regarded or widely known or distributed films before Blow Up. And then after the film, he'll have a part in Camelot, he'll have a part in Tony Richardson's The Charge of the Light Brigade, Barbarella, but it's really going to be very rare that you're going to see a film that he's in as an actor of this caliber. But you mentioned that there was another film connection for Hemmings in terms of...
Well, David Hemmings, along with his partner, John Daly, inspired the name of one of the most famous and infamous independent film companies of the 80s and beyond, a Hemdale, with the producer, the ones who really gave Oliver Stone his big break with Platoon and Salvador, and a few other good pictures and some other not so good ones, and went down in a spectacular flame of bankruptcy at some point. But they were buccaneers in their own right and left some very good work behind.
And Vanessa Redgrave had already appeared in Carol Reese's Morgan by this time, and Camelot would be the following year, so she was on the ascension as well. Although her role and Sarah Miles's role, they're kind of supportive of the roles. Her character is only technically in two scenes.
Right, of course, one of those scenes is about 20 minutes long. It almost kind of reminded me of My Night at Maud's, where there's a very daringly long scene in the middle of both of those films, but it works.
Absolutely. And I'm very worried for Dan Cahill, our cinematography expert. I don't know what he's going to talk about today. There's hardly anything to talk about Blow Up's visual look. I am being ironic.
It's like a vast red desert. Nothing out there for me. I'm just going to sort of plow through the movie and note things that I think are of interest. This is probably one of the second or third scenes where he's starting his photo shoot of the Russian model Verushka. And we're introduced to her by a reflection in clear glass. This is an interesting effect, and it kind of alerts you to, oh, this guy uses his camera in very tricky ways. I don't know if they're trying to photograph the model or the dress she's in. It's unclear what the purpose is, but One thing that's interesting is how intensely involved Thomas, our protagonist, is in coaching and inspiring her to pose. It's also interesting to realize that we never, ever, in the course of the movie, see any of these fashion shots that he has made. They are just not of interest to Antonioni, I'm sure. It's just a way of setting the scene. Incidentally, I just want to say, when this movie came out, it was cool. And that was part of its popularity. And it's still cool today. The look of this film is not 50-some years old. It looks as if it could have been made today. This is probably, the first or second scene where we realize he doesn't treat women very well, in particular those that he is working with. He's not a nice person through most of the film. As he's delaying his romp with the two, I could call them teeny boppers, I think that was an important term of the time, he does this little coin manipulation thing that is actually fairly easy to teach yourself. I know a bit about magic and illusions, and this is not all that challenging. And as Max referred earlier, the taller of the two young ladies is Jane Birkin, who had an interesting career. She's done some acting, including one in Old Age, which was a wonderful film. I think it's called The Lady and the TGV, or Train Grande Vitesse. It's a woman who lives by a railroad track where the fast train goes by. And she was probably in her 60s or 70s by the time that film came out a few years ago. She had a notorious career. She married a guy named Serge Gainsbourg, and they wrote a song, Je t'aime moi non plus, which was supposed to sound very erotic. This is an interesting scene, and I want to talk about this. This is where he's showing the photos, like the previous one that he took in the Doss house. He's showing them to his either agent or editor, I'm not sure which, but there is ongoing dialogue to the present day about, was the murder real or not? And there's evidence on both sides, but this is a sequence here, which I think explains several things and is testament to the fact that, yes, it was a murder that he photographed. So they're sitting in this restaurant looking at the photos, and the agent says to him, someone you know? And we get this reverse angle of someone who turns his head away just as the camera cuts to him. Here is the Yardbirds concert and the recently deceased master guitarist Jeff Beck, who is unhappy with the way his guitar is sounding, decides to bash it against the amp, thereby destroying it. And it's worth noting that the audience for most of this performance is virtually catatonic until the guitar gets stomped and thrown into the audience. And at that point, Thomas decides he wants it. But later on, when he gets outside, he doesn't want it anymore, which is a statement about something about this guy. And this is just some other passerby looking at the neck. He picks it up, and then he throws it aside himself. A couple of other things I just wanted to mention that I don't have particularly good frames for is they originally used a photographer to shoot the scenes in the park that were what Thomas was filming. And that photographer used a large format 2.25 square Hasselblad camera. The film in that was very fine grain. And when they did the enlargements, you couldn't see the grain. They wanted to see the images deteriorate as they got larger. So they ended up using a film that I used frequently back in the day, black and white film called Tri-X, ASA 400. And it's got plenty of grain. And that's what they used to show these enlargements degrading even further. So interesting little anecdote there.
That's fantastic, Dan. One of the shots when David Hemmings and we think either his agent or his manager have their backs to the camera, they're staring through the blinds at the restaurant of the man who may be spying on David Hemmings.
Right.
I have a theory about that shot.
Share it, please.
Because the camera begins tracking leftward as Hemmings is either moving around in his chair, and then suddenly the action shifts to the other side of the table where he's looking through the blinds. I have a theory that that was supposed to be a continuous camera movement because it's kind of an awkward transition for Antonioni. I think something didn't work out or something didn't go to Antonioni's wishes, and they decided to just bridge the two shots together.
It could have been that this mysterious character, possibly the killer, showed his face too much, and they needed to cut it out to keep it more mysterious. If we got a good look at the guy, it would sort of spoil a lot of the mystery and the enigmatic nature of the storytelling.
That's a good theory. And there's something that I don't think we can overstate enough, is the political relevance of a man capturing with a camera a murder, because the whole memory of the assassination of President Kennedy was still on everybody's mind with Abraham Zapruder's 8mm film.
Oh, yes.
Purchased and suppressed by Time Life and doctored by the CIA and all that stuff, that having recorded a murder, certainly blow up references that.
The world saw those grainy, enlarged images of Kennedy being murdered, and they're indelible in our minds and our memories. So it's a sad fact, but Antonioni was part of the world that knew what we were thinking.
Exactly. Well,
you know, wildly, guys, there's a 1-hour documentary about Antonioni, which is on the Eclipse Criterion DVD. I was watching it the other night. And speaking of promoting legends or myths or whatever, there's a passage in this doc where Antonioni is speaking about something which my jaw dropped. He said that he was called by President Kennedy into his office, sounded like either in 1961 or 62, and Kennedy proposed to him that he make an improvisational film about the astronauts who were then preparing to go to the moon. This was when President Kennedy had promised we were going to put a man on the moon by the end of the 60s. Can you imagine Antonioni sitting in the Oval Office with President Kennedy discussing a project like that? Now, we know that Kennedy had some unusual tastes. He saw certain, you know, sophisticated films and was very well read. I don't know whether I can imagine him seeing La Ventura and La Notte and like this, maybe. But I've never seen that story told anywhere else but by Antonioni, so we have to wonder. But
what intrigues me about your anecdote is, as a filmmaker, wouldn't that make a cool scene to film? Antonioni and Kennedy sitting there talking about how to shoot astronauts who are still on Earth. Gosh, we better hurry up and get that written before.
Well, the president's log books probably still exist in the National Archives or something. And maybe now we have to dig into this a little deeper now that we.
Absolutely. Dan, you mentioned a song that Jane Birkin and Serge Gainsbourg sang, Je T'aime. There's a young girl who's part of that song that is their daughter, Charlotte Gainsbourg. And it is a very erotic song. It's between.
It actually, is. I was living in Morocco at the time in the late 60s, and we heard that on the radio and thought, what is this? Of course, we were able to speak French, so we kind of understood the lyrics better than a lot of people would. But speaking of that time frame, this film came out during my junior year in college, and it sort of set a template for how a lot of us looked at the world and what we thought was cool and what wasn't cool. And years, decades later, this would have been in 2007, Antonioni died on July 30th of that year, on the very same day that Ingmar Bergman died. And the next day or two, I was teaching a class in directing at New York Film Academy for high school students. This was a special summer class. And I just put the whole class on pause and said, look, we got to talk about something. And I sat on the edge of the desk and I told them what life was like for film buffs in the mid 60s, that everybody went to the theater because word of mouth was out that there was a really interesting film that was challenging and provocative and intelligent. And we would talk about it later. Over beers and cigarettes, some of us were still doing that. We didn't necessarily go to cafes, but, you know, all over the place, people were talking about Blow Up. And I remember the faces of these students, about half of them, their eyes were kind of glossy like the Yardbirds audience. But half of them were kind of going, hey, yeah, yeah, that's kind of cool. You could do that in college, right? So, you know, it was almost a watershed film for my circle of friends, at least.
Because it was certainly making that shift from what exclusively would have been the art house arena into the mainstream movie-going arena. There are not many films did that.
But exactly.
That enabled the audiences to cross over.
It got distribution in mainstream cinemas. You didn't have to go to the art house place to see it. I have one other, maybe not one, but a couple of other interesting bits of research. As I was looking at this storyboard that he was setting up on his wall, it occurred to me that Hitchcock would easily have admired this film. And I just Googled Hitchcock on blow up. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that in 1966, he was working with a writer named Howard Fast, who wrote Spartacus and several other things. They were collaborating on a project called Kaleidoscope, which was later abandoned. But this is what I found on the internet. The first time Hitchcock saw blow up, he was struck dumb. My God, Hitchcock blurted to screenwriter Howard Fast. I've just seen Michelangelo Antonioni's blow up. These Italian directors are a century ahead of me in terms of technique. What have I been doing all this time? He would watch the film repeatedly, absorbing the same hazy color palette and rough cynicism into his work.
That's fabulous.
Yeah, these people know each other's work, okay? They're not living in bubbles.
I have another director anecdote for you. So Stanley Donen is in New York promoting his film Two for the Road with Audrey Hepburn and Albert Finney, which New Plaza showed a number of years ago at another location.
And you spoke at that screening, Max, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I did speak at the screening. And Bosley Crowther of the New York Times is interviewing Donen after Two for the Road. And he's openly saying how much he dislikes the film and says that it's far inferior to Blow Up. And Donen said, well, as far as I'm concerned, Mr. Crowther, Blow Up is a cross between Funny Face and Rear Window. And you, Mr. Crowther, are a very rude man. But that shows the impact. And apparently there was rousing applause in the audience. But anyhow.
Well, there are other references. If you go a little deeper into Googling Hitchcock and Blow Up, you will find a lot of people doing comparison studies between Rear Window and Blow Up, which deal with voyeuristic photography, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe Antonioni was imitating Rear Window. I'm sure he'd seen it. I'm sure he knew what it was.
But really, this is an Antonioni picture. I mean, just because it deals with voyeurism, it's easy for everyone to say, oh, it's Hitchcockian in theme. But it's an Antonioni picture through and through in the way the scenes are laid out that you so powerfully illustrated to us, the way the characters are developed or underdeveloped, what's said, what's not being said. It's certainly not the Hitchcock approach to such material.
And again, Antonioni specializes in the unresolved, the enigmatic, the unknowable things. That's what his films are like. I am not repulsed by that. I'm rather drawn in by them. There is a wonderful film called About Ellie by the Iranian filmmaker Asghar Farhadi. I don't know if you've seen it or not, but it's about the disappearance of a young woman on a vacation site. And, well, I'm not going to spoil the ending, but it's kind of similar to L'Avventura. I'll say that much. So it's interesting to see these crossovers between wildly different cultures and communities.
Because some of the Iranian cinema pacing, when I think of some of the key directors of the Iranian cinema movement, there are some Antonioni elements to the pacing of some of those films. Absolutely.
I think that's a pretty good canvas.
This discussion was facilitated by film historian Max Alvarez, film curator Gary Palmucci, and cinematography expert Dan Cahill. Also, special thanks to Norma Levy, Marianne Tesler, Sean Moore, and Polly Rittenberg for making the production of this podcast possible. This podcast was produced, edited, and narrated by Hannah Kavanaugh. Yours truly. Thank you so much for listening, everyone, and enjoy the holiday weekend.